Welcome, listeners. This is Dr. Harry's podcast number 10. I'm Julian Lasseau, practice manager, and with me is my friend and colleague, Dr. David Hindmarsh.
That's me.
And we're going to be discussing some research papers from the BMJ and a couple of other bits and pieces that we've come across that are of interest as well. Not entirely connected to COVID this month, but we have got some stuff that is connected to COVID. And we're going to start with an article entitled, "Could Better Connecting of Data Lead to a Cure for COVID-19? And this is from Digital Health, which is an online thing that I subscribe to. And they're sort of interested in digital technology and its impact on health. This article is written by a character called Alexandra Jarasch, who's the head of data and knowledge management at Munich's head office of the German Centre for Diabetes Research. And what he's saying is that all the amount of sort of different studies and different information that we're now putting together about diseases is becoming so voluminous that it's really difficult to kind of tabulate and particularly it's difficult to spot the cross connections between different bits of information.
Yeah.
And he's saying that in order to try to keep tabs on this kind of information, which is really kind of, you know, where there are lots and lots of different aspects to it,
yes,
and information of different types, but all that can relate to, where different parts of the information can relate to each other in a multitude of different ways,
right,
that they've developed new kind of databases. So he says here, the problem faced by anyone trying to study complex diseases like cancer, diabetes, heart disease and dementia is that the analysis methods we have relied upon to reach have reached their limits. And he says that what they normally do is kind of stick information into Excel spreadsheets and then transfer it into old-fashioned relational databases, which are... So a spreadsheet is like a flat, tabulated list of a particular type of information.
Right.
So a classic example would be the names and addresses of all your patients.
Yes.
You can put that in a spreadsheet.
Yeah.
And then if all your patients have got,
yeah,
let's say all of your patients have got different repeat prescriptions.
Yeah.
Okay. You could have your first table, which has got all your patient names and addresses.
Yes.
And then a second table, which has got all these different repeat prescriptions.
Yes.
And you create a relationship between the two.
Yes.
And that's a relational database. So you've got different tables of information.
Right. Yes.
And you specify what the relationship is between, yes, table A and table B.
Yes.
So you say, for each patient that is an a unique entity, but they can have lots of these different prescriptions,
yes,
which are not unique in the same way. They can belong to lots of different patients, so,
yes,
that's called a one-to-many relationship.
Right. Okay. Yeah.
Now, what he's saying, this guy, is that, yeah, there's a new approach to working with large, complex data sets, and this new approach is called graph databasing.
Right.
So graph databases could turn out to be crucial in helping the prevention, discovery of new subtypes, early diagnosis and treatment of major illnesses. Now, I don't 100% understand how graph databases work,
no,
but as far as I can work it out, and I've had a look at this, if they're open source, which is one of the things I
yes,
like the sound,
yeah,
of.
Yeah.
But there's some graph software which he mentions called Neo4j,
right,
and you can look that up on the web, and that is open source software. And basically, I think from what I can work out, it enables, yeah, you to put your data into different tables,
right?
But the relationships between those different data sets,
yes,
are fluid and dynamic,
right.
So they can,
yeah,
you can find lots of and you can query them in different ways, so you,
yes,
can find lots of different relationships between them,
yes,
that might not have existed before,
right?
And that enables you to start looking at the data that you've got,
yes,
in a much more kind of flexible and dynamic,
right,
way,
yeah,
and to discover things about it that you might not have already known. So the thing,
right,
about a traditional,
yeah,
relational database is that,
yeah,
you already have in your mind what you think the relationships between the different data tables are.
Right, yes.
And that's how you set,
yeah,
your database up. With,
yes,
this one,
yeah,
you just put all your information, as far as I understand it, you just put your information into different tables,
yes,
and then you can find what the relationships between these different bits,
right,
of data are.
Right.
And so you can discover these unexpected relationships between things.
Yes, yeah.
So
it might be people with diabetes, and it just happens that they live close to a very good sweet shop.
Yeah, that kind of thing,
sort of,
yes.
Yes, yeah.
But it might be something more bizarre than that. It might be,
yeah,
and what,
yeah,
he's talking about is using this for COVID research. They've,
right,
evidently started using it for COVID research.
Yeah, yeah.
And he says, down the bottom here, we've just added a clinical trials database to understand what kind of COVID-19 clinical trials are out there. The data set specifies typical inclusion criteria, such as people under a certain age or specific risk group, like diabetic patients.
Yes.
This is valuable information that is usually scattered across different databases, and now we can bring it together and link it with everything else.
Mm.
An early breakthrough has been around ACE2, the host cell receptor that mediates infection by SARS-CoV-2.
Right.
One might assume that the receptor ACE2 is just active in lung tissue because one of the most vulnerable groups for the virus is patients with lung disease.
Mm-hmm.
But it turns out that of 55 human tissues in our database, the receptor is active in 53 of them.
Right.
So you look at this ACE2 receptor,
yes,
and you think you know a certain thing about it,
yes,
but actually when you query this graph database, because,
yeah,
it's got these flexible connections,
yeah,
it highlights the fact that it's got
those,
these properties,
yeah,
that you didn't expect,
yeah,
and so you start discovering things,
right,
that are there in the data set,
yeah,
but you didn't know you knew them, kind of thing. So they're,
right,
kind of buried information in the,
yes,
data set.
Yeah, yeah.
So he says, it's our hope that surfacing details like this via our use of data will prove useful in the race to find a COVID-19 vaccine.
Right.
That's what has taken us to the next level in precision medicine, prevention,
right,
and treatment of diabetes, which,
right,
is his particular interest.
Yeah, his thing, isn't it? Yeah.
So,
yeah,
it's just, it's a very geeky thing, but,
yeah,
it's quite interesting,
well,
to
it
me.
It is interesting, yeah.
Because it's a new way of looking at,
yes,
data,
yeah,
and also because of the open source aspect,
yes,
to it, which,
yeah,
which I'm quite keen on.
Yeah.
So, so that's, as I say, that's in Digital Health, and when we put this online, I'll publish the link to the article if anybody,
yeah,
wants to go and,
yeah,
have a look at it in more detail.
So, where does all the data come from?
These are existing trials.
Oh,
so
I see.
You're
right,
pulling together. You're pooling all these,
right,
these bits of data from,
right,
all over the place.
Yes.
But it's querying it in a new way that,
right,
hasn't been tried,
right,
before, that starts to throw up these interesting kind of...
I bet he's very excited about that.
I think he is. I think he can be very excited if he ever listens,
yeah,
to this podcast.
Yes.
This is right up his alley.
Yes, it is.
So that'll do for that one. The next one is called COVID-19,
yeah,
a fork in the road for general,
yes,
practice. And this is from the BMJ. And it's BMJ M3709 as the reference.
Yeah.
And it's subtitled, We Must Choose a Personal, Not an Impersonal Future.
Right, right.
And in broad terms, what he's saying is that there's been this massive change in how we deal with patients in primary care, but,
yes,
in medicine
in general, yes, yeah,
as a result of COVID.
Mm.
And the most obvious,
right,
change is that we've gone from using face-to-face consultations,
yes,
as,
yeah,
the norm,
yes,
to telephone consultations,
yeah,
as the norm, and, you know, with a few video consultations thrown in.
Yes. Yeah.
And he's saying that when we come out of COVID, that means that we're going to be sort of in a position where big changes have already happened.
Yes.
We have to decide,
yeah,
A, do we reverse those changes?
Yes. Yeah.
Which I think probably most people aren't going to do. But B, if we're going to keep those changes, how are we going to move forward with them? I mean, what's the new model of general practice going to be like?
Yes, yeah.
And specifically, is it going to be sort of more impersonal because we're not seeing patients face to face?
Yeah,
we might be dealing with them via things like electronic consultations as well as telephone consultations, you know, Doctor Link and e-consult and things like that. Are we going to go further and further down that path of trying to deal with people in a hands-off way? So what do you think?
Well, I think I think you're missing out on human connection, really. You know, getting something back in writing. There's no room for discussion or, you know, whether, you know, how do you feel about this? Anything like that? It's just sort of looks as if it's factual, but you're not giving someone.
You're talking about e-consultations there, are you? Or are you? How do you feel about the telephone consultations?
Well, the telephone consultation, you can have a conversation.
Yeah.
And you know, you probably do get to a point where somebody says, "Well, actually, my real concern about this pain in my big toe is that that I might have cancer of the kneecap," or something like that.
Yeah.
You know? So that's all right. But what you can't do on the telephone is examine someone,
right,
or smile at them,
right,
or, you know, and, you know, make a proper human connection. And I think that's what's important about the continuity of care, which there's been a lot of in the past, and there's probably becoming less of as we get into bigger and bigger practices.
Yeah.
And also in secondary care, you know, that you're a bit like a, you know, a sausage on a sausage machine, really. You know, you're on a conveyor belt.
Yeah.
You've got this disorder, this disease. You've got to go through this process of care.
Yeah.
And if you don't agree with it, well, you're very stupid.
Yes. Yeah, well, we'll come on to treatments for prostate cancer in a minute.
Yes,
but I mean, he mentions, I think, non-verbal cues is one of the, I say he mentions. It's actually a number of different people writing this article.
Yes.
But the non-verbal cues are one thing that that are mentioned. And do you find that's a... I mean, because non-verbal cues are part of your consultation
technique,
aren't they?
Yes. Yes, and you can just tell how anxious somebody is by looking at their behaviour, you know.
Yeah. Twitching
their feet
or avoiding your eyes
or maybe tears going down their face and things like that.
Yes. And do you find have you found in telephone consultations that you feel as if you're not quite
I think
you're
I've
not
always,
quite attuned to the patient as closely as you would be if you were face to face.
I think so, definitely, and perhaps that, you know, has a, you know, perhaps they're thinking, well, I'd better not say that because they might think that, you know, the doctor might think I'm a bit silly or something like that.
Yeah.
But if you're face to face and you're making that connection, you know, come in, sit down. You know,
it's more relaxed,
and then maybe they start crying or something like that. You give them a tissue. It's like it's more a sort of an acceptance of things, and and you're not making a judgment of that person.
So here's an interesting question. We bring people in for face to face consultations, and normally it strikes me working in, you know, reception and the admin side of things.
Yes.
Normally the criterion for bringing somebody in for a face-to-face
yes.
is because they've got a lump or something
yes, exactly.
that needs physical
yes.
examination.
You're right, yes.
Do you think that that maybe that the criterion for bringing people in for a face-to-face is that they need to have a discussion with you about something personal that,
yes.
that you can't get the non-verbal cues or get properly attuned with them about over the telephone?
I think there's an element of that, but you're, you know, just going back to the first bit of what you're saying, that, you know, even with video consultations or photographs of people's skin disorders,
yeah.
you're not getting the same, you know, the same pictures you would with seeing somebody in
the flesh
of as reality. Yes.
Yeah.
I think it's most of our consultations are, as you say, people who need to be examined.
Mm. Well, I don't know about most of them. It'd be interesting to know what the percentages
right.
are like.
Yes.
So it certainly does crop up, but
yes.
But a lot of, we do a lot of consultations for people who you know, basically you're just kind of going through their blood test results or
yes.
talking to them
yes.
about, you know.
You're right, yeah. They're, you know, people who have just got a, you know, a recent diagnosis of cancer or something
yeah,
like that.
Yeah, having a conversation with them about
that. And they
that
really
kind of thing.
Want to have the conversation and telephone isn't good enough for that.
Yeah.
And that's them saying that, you know, not that I don't agree with it, because
no.
I do. Really,
well, you did that
yeah.
home visit just recently
yeah.
for that patient with, well, there was
yeah.
two patients who'd both
yeah.
been diagnosed with cancer more or less at the same time. And,
yes, yeah.
And part of the reason for the home visit, I take it, was
yes.
not that they were incapable of coming in here, but
no.
that you felt it was something you wanted to sit
yes.
down and talk to them
yes.
about.
And that's their safe environment as
yeah.
well.
Yeah.
But it's interesting because, you know, just thinking about the continuity side of it, the fact is that the continuity with those two people was already there for the last 30 years.
Yes. Yeah.
You know, they've been in, you know, they've been my patients and I've been their doctor
yes.
for all that time. And of course, you can't help but, you know, have some sort of relationship and some caring for those people.
Mm.
Not that you shouldn't have for anybody, you know, who's a new patient. Of course
no.
you should.
No.
But it does have an effect on behaviour.
But you develop a relationship of trust, or you hope
yes,
you do.
I think that's
and that
exactly
makes it easier
it.
To go into
yes.
somebody's house and have a really personal
yeah.
conversation
yeah.
with them about something
yeah.
like a cancer diagnosis.
Yes. Yes, but it's not just the fact that, you know, it might be a good way of making a connection and finding a way forwards with people. The continuity, there was some research done some years ago that looked at that the practices who had more continuity of care had lower admission rates to hospital
mm.
in the over 80s.
Yes.
So, and that was some clever bloke who wrote loads of books about audits, you know, all those years ago. It was up in Guy's somewhere, wasn't it?
Yeah, well, those figures were skewed by Harold Shipman, of course.
He
used to kill all his patients over 80,
yes.
and therefore they never went to hospital.
Yes, that's true.
I mean, there's a kind of, in here, in this article, it
yeah.
says about 15-minute consultations.
Yes.
And they're saying... So one of these things that they're saying is that telephone consultations should give you an opportunity
yeah.
to have longer consultations.
Right.
And they're saying fewer face-to-face contacts make it possible. So fewer face-to-face contacts as opposed to, yeah, I suppose that is saying because it's telephone consultations. But anyway,
yeah.
longer consultations are both more patient-centred and less stressful for clinicians.
Right.
And the UK is an international outlier in its reliance on short consultations.
Mm.
But I think down here they say that if you have higher quality, longer consultations,
yes.
then you end up with fewer consultations. That's
well,
what they're
depends,
saying.
I think, because there are some people who will always, you know, this going to be a quite a long, complicated consultation because of their mindset and how they think and that sort of thing.
Mm.
I think there are some that it probably doesn't apply. Tell me again.
Well, if you've got better quality consultations, you end up, and they're a bit longer as part of the better quality, you actually end up with fewer consultations, is what they're suggesting, I think.
Yes.
And it's saying some practices report annual face-to-face consultation rates as low as two per patient when using personal rather than combined lists and introducing 15-minute consultations. So what they're saying is you get better continuity of care, longer consultations, you'll end up seeing the same patients fewer times.
Well, that is quite possible, yes. If you sort something out, or the doctor and the patient sort things out, and they have an understanding and a good plan.
Yeah.
Then you're probably helping to solve the problem, and they might doesn't mean that they won't have to come back because something else might develop. But even so, I think that's if it's good communication, so, that probably is.
Yeah. So shorter consultations. Perhaps encourage you to put things off for another time, and poor continuity of care, where the same patient is seen by lots of different doctors in quick succession, may also encourage each doctor to just say, "We'll do a few blood tests and come back and see somebody else with this," you know, as opposed to actually kind of taking responsibility.
Yes, you could even think in that way. You could think, "Yes, let's do the blood tests," and then tell them to come back in 2 weeks' time,
and they'll probably see somebody else, and it's somebody else's problem, sort of thing.
Yes.
So.
Yes, it is. Can be passing the buck a bit, can't it?
Yeah. So I suppose what they seem to be saying in this article is they're suggesting that there may be sort of time saving approaches in using sort of e-consultations and things that will then so you can maybe sort out things like sick notes and so forth and UTIs, I suppose, which are the two obvious ones that we do quite a lot of just administratively without the patients having to have a consultation as such.
Yes.
So if you can sort those things out through these other systems, then that buys you extra time to improve. As opposed to, I suppose what they're saying is whether you've got to make up your mind whether you're going to do that or you're just going to say, well, we can save some time, we'll leave everything else the same, but we'll actually just save time by getting rid of some of, you know, and make it, but generally sort of making a move towards more arm's length dealing with patients. So more e-consultations, more telephone consultations, but you know, not longer consultations, just kind of packaging things and making them more sort of algorithm driven and workflow driven than they have been before.
Yeah, I mean, I think that telephone consultations can have other drawbacks because somebody will say, you phone up Mr. So-and-so, and he says, I know this for me, but can I just talk about my wife for a bit, you know, that sort of thing. And, I've run out of these tablets. Could I just order these tablets for me? And all this sort of thing. So there's a bit of, you know, the arm's length. Though you haven't got the control so much, you know, you can't say, oh, by the way, that's the door.
Yes, well, I haven't got time for that now. Ask them in reception. Although you do actually try to do that, don't you? Well, you wouldn't mind ringing back and making the appointment with reception.
Which is,
I mean, I think your main problem with telephone consultations is telephone tennis, isn't it? This business you ring a patient, they don't pick up, you move on to the next patient, they ring back while you're on the next patient.
Yes, exactly.
Oh, it's, can you please bring you back? I'm sorry, I missed it. Yes. You know, you can play that game all morning if you're not careful.
And I think the other thing, I think this says somewhere at the top there, that the big issue with the online stuff is the, you know, some elderly people are just not going to be able to cope with it.
Yeah, so that's true.
They're going to be, you know, have slightly reduced access to their doctor.
Yes, I mean, I suppose that's another aspect of what's happened during COVID, because we definitely got, I mean, you know, to some extent it's been a bit of a godsend, because we used to have people who just barged in without an appointment, yes, and insisted on being true. Seen there,
yes,
and there.
Yeah.
And COVID, yes, has just put that to bed.
Yes,
basically.
It did, yes, for various reasons, yes.
But you know, conversely, we've got people who haven't got telephones.
Yes.
Or people who, as you say, aren't very good with the online stuff.
Yeah. Yeah.
Or people who can't write.
Yes.
It's probably more difficult for them to access our medical service now than it used to be.
They could be the more vulnerable patients anyway.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So you know, like all these things, there's good aspects and bad aspects.
Yes, I think that's true. Yes, there are quite a lot of elderly people, you know, even older than me, who are quite good at technology, you know.
Yes, that's true.
They send in their photos of their warts and things.
Yeah.
Whether we like it or
not. I suppose the video, that kind of thing, like the video consultations and using your mobile phone to do something clever, like taking a picture of your wart and emailing it to the GP, that kind of thing tends to be easier for the young than it is for the old, by and large.
Yes, yeah. Yeah.
So we haven't reached any earth-shattering conclusions, but we think probably you've got to steer a bit carefully with implementing.
Yeah, I think it's important not to lose human connection, really.
Yeah.
And it is, you know, some of the old ladies do like to have a hug.
Yes.
You know, and, you know, there's nothing wrong with that.
Well, except that you might infect them with COVID, or they might infect you.
That's true. But once
COVID's over and done with,
you're
going to go back to hugging all the old ladies.
Yeah. Oh, yes.
I'll see you in prison.
Yes, all right.
Okay, well, shall we move on to the prostate cancer, which is quite interesting.
It is interesting, yeah. It's got quite a sort of muddle of the different things with the different, you know, different treatments.
So let's give the title and the reference to this for the benefit of our listener.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So 15-year quality of life outcomes in men with localised prostate cancer.
Yeah.
Population-based Australian prospective study. As you can tell by the title, this is a proper piece of research.
Yeah.
And the reference, this is another BMJ one, the reference is M3503.
Mm.
Now, you're going to have to help me out, because I don't really know what these different types of treatment are.
Yeah.
As far as I can make out, there isn't, like, the tamsulosin drug treatment in here.
No, that's just for not prostate cancer, that's for enlarged prostate and lower urinary tract symptoms.
So these are all actual kind of interventions.
Yeah. Yes.
So just run me through what the different types are. Hang on a minute. So
you've got the robotic nerve saving, you know, operation, you know, removing the whole prostate.
External beam radiation therapy.
Well, that's external beam. Yes.
So they beam you with radiation.
Yeah. And then there's
high-dose rate brachytherapy.
Brachytherapy, I think, is where it's around the prostate. I might be wrong with that, but I think that's how it is, that they put some, I don't know what they are, little pellets of radioactive stuff in the area.
Right. And then this androgen deprivation therapy.
I think that must be the Solidex type of thing. That's
right.
Yes.
So
it gets rid of your testosterone.
Okay.
I
think those are all the different types that they mention.
Or apart from, they mentioned watchful waiting.
Right.
Active surveillance.
Yes.
Which is not really a therapy at all. It is just surveillance.
Yeah. Yeah.
And the other interesting thing is that they compared the results of the various troubles that people had with it. What do they call them? They didn't say troubles, they said another word, didn't they?
Urinary bother is one of the phrases they use.
Yes,
sexual bother and things like that. Sexual bother. And I think sort of bowel symptoms as well.
Yes, exactly, because of the radiotherapy particularly, But what they compared it with was people who had not got all these different bothers.
Mm.
The control group was people who didn't have prostate cancer.
Yeah.
So
this is, I think this is kind of new research in that they're looking at 15-year quality of quality of life outcomes, I should say, and that hasn't been, that length of time hasn't been kind of factored into the research before, according to what they say.
Yes.
And broadly speaking, the outcomes are.
There are some different outcomes in different people, but the one that is a bit surprising, well, maybe not surprising, is that the sexual bother bit seems to be higher, I'm sure it says later on in here somewhere, is higher in the people who've had the robotic nerve, you know, saving, you know, treatments.
What, when you'd expect it to be lower?
Well, that's, you know, that's what the, you know, the sort of general idea that people get, that, well, this is, you know, this is going to, you know, not interfere with my erections and things like that.
Sexual function and bother.
Yeah.
Sexual function scores in men treated for localised prostate cancer were lower than in population-based controls for all treatment groups at all follow-up points. And in adjusted absolute terms, the two prostatectomy surgery groups had the worst sexual function scores relative to controls.
So you'd think it was, you know, the other way around. If it's very careful surgery and they're, you know, not fiddling around with your nerves too much and cutting them.
That hence the phrase nerve sparing.
Yes, exactly.
You still have good sexual function afterwards, but doesn't seem to be the case.
No, but the other interesting thing is that...
Men with external beam radiation therapy, hydroxyurate brachytherapy, reported little recovery in sexual function across the whole 15-year period, and the group receiving low-dose rate brachytherapy, who, after initial improvement, reported a decline in erectile dysfunctional score after year five.
But the fact is, you know, you're 5 years older then as a man, and I think the sort of testosterone level peaks when you're 17,
and
then it starts falling after that.
Yes. So what can you do?
Yeah, what can you do? But the other interesting thing with it was that the men with the sexual dysfunction, as they got older, were less bothered by the fact that their sexual functioning wasn't as good as it used to be. But there was something else but there were other things that they were more upset about. So, and I can't remember what they were.
I think the urinary bother, I seem to remember.
I think you're right. I think that's what it was. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. The urinary bother was more of a bother than the sexual bother.
Yeah.
Yeah. The most apparent and persisting adverse association was
a reduction in sexual function, although this caused limited bother in men.
Yes.
In contrast, while urinary incontinence was less prevalent, it was a greater cause of bother.
Yes. Well, thinking all the washing you'd have to do and...
Yeah.
But it was interesting, wasn't it? I think one of the things that they were saying is that, you know, that we need to be able to have a better conversation with people about what the implications of the various treatments are. But maybe not we, maybe it's urologists.
The urologist, yeah. But we've certainly had cases of people who've gone in for sort of prostate treatment.
Yes.
Uprooted mountains in an attempt to have a prostate treatment that would spare their sexual function.
Yes.
And it's just not worked at all, basically.
No, that's true, yes. And I suppose, you know, there are surgeons and surgeons and there are robots and robots as well.
Yes, and different centres of treatment. And And, of course, the individual patient is going to be different from another individual patient. But But yeah, I mean, this is kind of one of the articles that sort of plays into the BMJ's too much medicine agenda to some extent, isn't it?
Yes, it is.
It's a finding of perhaps you're better off just leaving it alone.
Yes. Yeah.
Because all treatment groups report that basically the unsatisfactory outcomes.
Yes. Yeah. I think that the other thing with having, a tumour removed from your body, mentally that might seem like a better option than somebody sticking some radiotherapy around your prostate or giving, zapping it.
Yeah.
That's going to have adverse effects in that area anyway. So it's gone.
Yes.
It's gone then. That's it.
Yes.
You think.
But that might be a sort of false way of looking at it to some extent.
Yes, yeah. But there are definitely some people who would think that might be that's a better route for me.
Mm. So it's about it's about the conversation.
I think that's probably right.
Okay, well, shall we move on to... So again, this is COVID-related in a way.
Yeah.
Taking a well-being years approach to policy choice. And this is another BMJ article.
Yes.
M3853, this is. What they're talking about in this article is... this suggestion that what you should do when you're deciding whether to pursue this particular policy or that particular policy, particularly in areas like health, is try to calculate not sort of the monetary implications, but the implications in terms of well-being that it's going to have for the population at large.
Yes. Yeah.
Which seems a little... I mean, it is a little bit airy-fairy to some extent.
Yeah.
And you think to yourself, well, how can they calculate that? Because you don't really know for sure. Yeah. There are too many imponderables.
Yes.
But they make the point in this article that they're proposing a kind of unit of well-being called the well-be.
Yes.
And they make the point in the article that there is already a unit in medicine called a quali.
Yes, that's true. Yes.
Which is a sort of
quality of adjusted life years.
Yeah.
I'm reading that, by the way. I didn't know it.
I was impressed there for a moment.
Yeah.
And of course there are imponderables. I mean, if you take Brexit as an example, people do all this modelling for how much what's going to happen financially for us, but what's going to happen to the economic infrastructure of the UK?
Yes.
What's going to happen to growth? So there are all kinds of imponderables in that calculation as well.
Yeah, yeah.
As witness the fact that a lot of it is disputed. You know, there's all this business about, people thinking Brexit's going to be a terrible financial disaster for the country.
Yes.
That's just project fear.
Yes.
And in fact, you can project completely different outcomes if you use a different set of assumptions about it.
Yes. So that's interesting, that word assumptions, I think.
Yeah. So if you're talking about whether it's going to be good well-being outcomes or bad well-being outcomes, you tend to think the same thing. It's very imponderable.
It is imponderable. It depends where you stand, really, doesn't it? And individual people as well.
Yeah. What they're saying, if you pass me that other one from over there, so what they're saying is that actually you can kind of work it out.
Yeah.
And then you can adjust your assumptions.
Yes.
So what they did was that. So this article in the BMJ refers to a kind of experimental a trial of this method that they did.
Yes.
Called When to Release the Lockdown, a well-being framework for analysing cost and benefits.
Yes.
And this was this is published on the Centre for Economic Performance, which is something to do with the London School of Economics and the Economic and Social Research Council.
Right.
And they published this in April 2020, and they're trying to work out the yes. implications of coming out of lockdown early
yeah.
as opposed to coming out of lockdown late. Yeah. And it's not really so much a case of saying, you know, this is a good, coming out of lockdown early is a good idea or a bad idea.
Yes, yeah.
It's more a question of trying to work out how the methodology would work right. if you're doing it in terms of right. of well-bees.
Yes.
So, they sort of explain how they try to measure effects in terms of well-being years.
It's a 0 to 10 scale, isn't it?
Well, there's a 0 to 10 scale, yeah. 0 means not worth living.
Right.
And 1 meaning full health. So that's a life year. So wait a minute, that's a quality adjusted year.
Right.
So here we are. An average well-being in the UK is approximately 7.5, yeah. measured on a scale of 0 to 10. Yeah. So if you yes. give people the well-being questionnaire, you know, how did you yes. feel when you got up this morning?
Yeah.
The average is 7.5. So
that sounds quite high, doesn't it?
So really? if you count that, so one year is that one well-being year, they're saying, is worth 7.5.
Yes.
So if you count the loss of 1 year's yes. life,
yes,
then that's a loss of 7.5 yes. well-bees.
Yes. Yeah.
So that's the beginning of their calculation. Yes.
You lose 10 years of life. 75 well-bees.
Yes. So they go through things like income, for example.
Yeah.
We assume that if lockdown ended on 1st of May, output would recover to its 2019 level within 1 year. And then they calculate, using these assumptions, we can calculate the total loss of income, which would occur from 1st of May onwards for each date of leaving the lockdown.
Yes.
And then they calculate what the effect on well-being would have
yes.
of those different sort of outcomes.
Yeah.
And then they do this. So you can see that a kind of, unemployment.
Yes.
So here we go. Higher unemployment generates widespread fear,
yes.
has a hugely unsettling effect on the employed,
yeah.
and a typical estimate of the effect on one person's unemployment for a year,
yes.
when aggregated across the rest of the community, is 2.1 well-bees.
Right.
So they kind of produce this kind of mathematical calculation for different aspects of, like,
yes.
Economic yeah. recovery, unemployment, mental yeah. health, confidence in government, schooling, COVID-19 deaths,
yes.
road deaths. We assume a 73% reduction in road deaths.
That's
because
yes.
there's less driving around.
So if you do start driving around again, then you're going to kill lots of animals.
Yeah. Commuting, CO2 emissions, air quality,
yes. yeah.
other
yeah.
factors. And then they put it all together into this kind of... So,
yeah.
And as I say, it's not so much... It's still, I think, it's fair to say, a little bit far-fetched.
Yes.
But what they're trying to do is they're trying to establish... an alternative basis for calculating what's a good idea and what's a bad idea to
yes.
balance
yeah.
the kind of social
yes.
effects
yeah.
as against the economic effects
yes. yeah.
and put that all together into a single kind of calculation
yes. yeah.
because at the moment it does tend to fall into two camps. People who say,
yeah.
well, you can't keep locking down because of the economic effects.
Yes.
And on the other hand, the people who say, well, you can't keep going back to work because of the health effects.
You're
going to
pass on the virus to someone yeah. else. Yeah.
And so this is an attempt to put together a more sort of comprehensive, rounded
yes.
way of looking at
yeah.
it and
yeah.
to balance those things against each other.
Yeah, I think some of the uncertainty about it is, you know, what is well-being really?
Yeah.
How is that different from happiness or, you know, fulfillment?
Yeah.
Or...
But I think they're trying to take that yeah. kind of philosophical yeah. question out of the equation
right.
to some extent by
yeah.
talking about, you know, what we do. You know, because there is some science that I mean, this figure of 7.5 being the average well-being
yes.
that you get from people
yes.
is
yeah.
based on lots and lots of surveys of,
yes.
of people's well-being
yes.
and the effect of unemployment on people's well-being, for example. There's lots and lots of surveys that show what that effect is. So they're trying to just kind of, you know, you've got a measure of well-being, and you can show sort of from evidence that the effect of this, that, and the other on people's you know, quality people's of life, score whatever, of their own well-being is as follows. And so they so in a way that kind of gets you past the kind of philosophical question of what is well-being, how does it compare to happiness, because they're taking as their base standard how people answer the well-being questionnaire.
But the trouble is with that is that, you know, if the next day you might have a car crash and be paralyzed or something like that, you know, it's all changeable, isn't it?
Of course it is,
but it's a good way of looking at things in a way. You know, not just at, you know, what's the measurable is the money.
Yes.
And the measurement of, you know, well-being, you know, what's, you know, what matters might not be so easy to measure, really.
Yeah, I think they make the point about New Zealand.
Yes, they did.
Societies that have started applying this more holistic framework to policymaking, such as New Zealand, which now explicitly focuses its annual budget on improving well-being, a world place to navigate public health crises such as COVID-19 that cut across all areas of government. Well, of course, that's a slightly kind of loaded way of putting it. But I say, I mean, New Zealand have only just started doing this.
Yeah.
And of course, we don't really know what the long-term outcomes of this focus on well-being are going to be.
No.
But what we do know at the moment is New Zealand seems to be doing exceptionally well combating COVID. Yes. But that's not necessarily because they've got this focus on well-being. They're an island.
Yes, yes, been exactly. Able,
But you know, New Zealand are kind of like a bit of a sort of a groovy right on person's go-to government for how things ought to be done in the sense that they've got, you know, they have actually attempted to implement some of these kind of progressive ideas.
Yes.
In fact, David Cameron, I'm no fan of David Cameron, but David Cameron tried to put together some kind of a well-being framework.
Right.
Which we used to discuss in our evening meetings. Do you remember me bringing out all the different, a big chart of all the different factors that go into this well-being framework that for the UK that he kind of
hand.
No, well, it's quite interesting because and the idea of that was that that should become a policy driver.
Well,
which I don't think it ever has done, really.
No,
but. But it's all compiled by the sort of National Office of Statistics, and it's things like, you know, what kind of environment you live in, and what you feel about your next door neighbours, what you feel about, you know, the society at large.
Well, that's quite interesting because this in the bottom of this page here, you know, the well-being benefits would include mental health, well-being in schools, further education, social care of the disabled and the elderly. So it's, you know, it's quite difficult to argue about those things, isn't it?
It is, but we do tend to, I mean, a lot of policy making does tend to rest on the assumption that if there's more wealth in the economy, then everybody feels, you know, that's better.
As opposed to
you know, if there's more friendliness in the society, then that's better. And you know, the an attempt to kind of look at all of those factors as opposed to either one or the other is, if you can actually formulate it effectively, that's a good thing. You would think
exactly. And they're saying, you know, is it the social, what needs rebuilding, the social infrastructure or the physical infrastructure? But I'm not sure that, you know, if you just had extra money, could you maximise the well-being of the population by giving them loads of cash?
Well, that's another interesting question, because there's the Finland have recently done the guaranteed minimum income thing.
Oh, right.
So instead of saying, you know, you can have, we've got a benefit system.
Yeah.
They said everybody, whether they work or they don't work, will get a guaranteed minimum income. And I think actually New Zealand were kind of looking at that.
Yes.
That possibility. And there's also been some research done recently into giving bundles of cash to vagrants.
Right.
So, you know, people, the homeless people and what have you, giving them like £1,000, I forget what the exact figure was.
Yeah.
And of course, the assumption is that they're going to go and spend it on meth.
Drugs,
But in fact, they don't. No. Once they've got some money, they use it. They try to use it as a lever to get themselves out of their
homelessness. That's really interesting, isn't it?
Start, you know. Yeah. I mean, my brother Justin came up with the idea years ago.
Yeah.
Instead of having this benefit system, why don't they just give everybody £1 million?
Yeah.
And there may be some length to that.
Exactly.
Idea.
Well, how many million people are there in the country now? Is it 70 or is it more than that now?
About 70, 70 to 80. Yeah,
70 million is nothing for the government.
70 to 80 million But even so, when you start talking about all these billions that are being spent on, you know, this, that, and the other, track and trace, then yes, it might. It seems like a balmy suggestion, but it might not be as balmy as it seems.
It would certainly cut down on and you think, bureaucracy a bit.
Yeah. So what else have we got left over there?
I don't think I want to do any more, to be honest.
You've had enough?
I've had enough. Okay. I've run out of things to think about.
Okay, your brain has exploded.
Yes, it's exploded.
And it's trickling down your face.
Yeah.
It's a good job, listeners, that you can't actually see this.
We could do this one next time, if anyone's interested.
We'll hold that over. Yeah. So, okay, well...
And they won't know what it is, so that would be
No, that's
exciting.
Right. It's fantastic. Oh, look at it. Yes. All these pictures of naked women. We'll discuss that next time. Okay, well, thank you for listening, if indeed you have been. And we'll be back next month.
Yeah, that's good. I enjoyed that.